He was several inches taller than Mac. He put his hand in the center of Mac's chest and shoved him powerfully away. Mac staggered backwards. The man turned again to the child. She was scrambling to her feet. He hit her a mighty slap to her face that sent her flying. Mac saw red. He grabbed the man by the collar and the seat of the breeches and lifted him bodily off the ground. The man roared with surprise and anger and began to writhe violently, but Mac held him and lifted him up over his head. Dermot stared in surprise at the ease with which Mac held him up. "You're a strong boy, Mac, by gob," he said.
"Get your filthy hands off me,"
the man shouted. Mac set him on the ground, but kept hold of one wrist.
"Just leave the child alone."
Dermot helped the girl stand up and held her gently but firmly.
"She's a damned thief," said the man aggressively.
Then he noticed Mac's ravaged face and decided not to make a fight of it.
"Is that all?" Mac said. "By the way you were kicking her, I thought she'd murdered the king."
"What business of yours is it, what she's done?"
The man was calming down and catching his breath. Mac let him go.
"Whatever it was, I think you've punished her enough."
The man looked at him.
"You're obviously just off the boat," he said. "You're a strong lad, but even so, you won't last long in London if you put your trust in the likes of her."
With that, he walked off. The girl said,
"Thanks, Jock. You saved my life."
People knew Mac was Scottish as soon as he spoke. He had not realized that he had an accent until he came to London. In Huyck, everyone spoke the same. Even the Jamiesons had a softened version of the Scots dialect. Here it was like a badge. Mac looked at the girl. She had dark hair, roughly cropped, and a pretty face already swelling with bruises from the beating. Her body was that of a child, but there was a knowing adult look in her eyes. She gazed warily at him, evidently wondering what he wanted from her. He said,
"Are you all right?"
"I hurt," she said, holding her side. "I wish you'd killed that Christ-forsaken John."
"What did you do to him?"
"I tried to rob him while it was fucking Cora, but he cottoned to it."
Mac nodded. He had heard that prostitutes sometimes had accomplices who robbed their clients.
"Would you like something to drink?"
"I'll kiss the Pope's arse for a glass of gin."
Mac had never heard such talk from anyone, let alone a little girl. He did not know whether to be shocked or amused. On the other side of the road was the Bear, the tavern where Mac had knocked down the Bermondsey Bruiser and won a pound from a dwarf. They crossed the street and went in. Mac bought 3 mugs of beer, and they stood in a corner to drink them. The girl tossed most of hers down in a few gulps and said,
"You're a good man, Jock."
"My name is Mac," he said. "This is Dermot."
"I'm Peggy. They call me Quick Peg."
"On account of the way you drink, I suppose,"
she grinned.
"In this city, if you don't drink quick, someone will steal your liquor. Where you from, Jock?"
"A village called Huyck, about 50 miles from Edinburgh."
"Where's Edinburgh?"
"Scotland."
"How far away is that, then?"
"It took me a week by ship down the coast."
It had been a long week. Mac was unnerved by the sea. After 15 years working down a pit, the endless ocean made him dizzy. But he had been obliged to climb the masts to tie ropes in all weathers. He would never be a sailor.
"I believe the stagecoach takes 13 days, he added.
"Why did you leave?"
"To be free. I ran away. In Scotland, coal miners are slaves."
"You mean like the blacks in Jamaica?"
"You seem to know more about Jamaica than Scotland."
She resented the implied criticism.
"Why shouldn't I?"
"Scotland is nearer, that's all."
"I knew that."
She was lying, Mac could tell. She was only a little girl, despite her bravado, and she touched his heart. A woman's voice said breathlessly,
"Peg, are you all right?"
Mac looked up to see a young woman wearing a dress the colour of an orange. Peg said,
"Hello, Cora. I was rescued by a handsome prince. Meet Scotch Jock McNook."
Cora smiled at Mac and said,
"Thank you for helping, Peg. I hope you didn't get those bruises in the process."
Mac shook his head.
"That was another brute."
"Let me buy you a drink of gin."
Mac was about to refuse. He preferred beer. But Dermot said,
"Very kind, we thank you."
Mac watched her as she went to the bar. She was about 20 years old, with an angelic face and a mass of flaming red hair. It was shocking to think someone so young and pretty was a whore. He said to Peg,
"So she shagged that fellow who chased you, did she?"
"She doesn't usually have to go all the way with a man,"
Peg said knowledgeably.
"She generally leaves him in some alley with his dick up and his britches down."
"While you run off with his purse," Dermot said.
"Me? Get off. I'm a lady in waiting to Queen Charlotte."
Cora sat beside Mac. She wore a heavy, spicy perfume that had sandalwood and cinnamon in it.
"What are you doing in London, Jock?"
He stared at her. She was very attractive.
"Looking for work?"
"Find any?"
"Not much."
She shook her head.
"It's been a whore of a winter, cold as the grave, and the price of bread is shocking. There's too many men like you."
Peg put in,
"That's what made my father turn to thieving 2 years ago, only he didn't have the knack."
Mac reluctantly tore his gaze away from Cora and looked at Peg.
"What happened to him?"
"He danced with the sheriff's collar on."
"What?"
Dermot explained.
"It means he was hanged."
Mac said, "Oh dear, I'm sorry."
"Don't feel sorry for me, you Scotch git. It makes me sick."
Peg was a real hard case.
All right, I won't,"
Mac said mildly.
Cora said, "If you want work, I know someone who's looking for coal heavers to unload the coal ships. The work is so heavy that only young men can do it, and they prefer out-of-towners who aren't so quick to complain."
"I'll do anything," Mac said, thinking of Esther.
"The coal-heaving gangs are all run by tavern keepers down in Wapping. I know one of them, Sidney Lennox at the Sun."
"Is he a good man?"
Cora and Peg laughed. Cora said,
"He's a lying, cheating, miserable-faced, evil-smelling, festering, drunken pig. But they're all the same, so what can you do?"
"Will you take us to the Sun?"
"Be it on your own head," said Cora.
A warm fog of sweat and coal dust filled the airless hold of the wooden ship. Mac stood on a mountain of coal, wielding a broad-bladed shovel, scooping up lumps of coal, working with a steady rhythm. The work was brutally hard. His arms ached and he was bathed in perspiration. But he felt good. He was young and strong, he was earning good money, and he was no one's slave. He was one of a gang of 16 coal heavers, bent over their shovels, grunting and swearing and making jokes. Most of the others were muscular young Irish farm boys. The work was too hard for stunted, city-born men. Dermot was 30, and he was the oldest on the gang. It seemed he could not escape from coal, but it made the world turn. As Mac worked, he thought about where this coal was going. All the London drawing-rooms it would heat, all the thousands of kitchen fires, all the bakery ovens and breweries it would fuel. The city had an appetite for coal that was never satisfied. It was Saturday afternoon, and the gang had almost emptied this ship, the Black Swan from Newcastle. Mac enjoyed calculating how much he would be paid tonight. This was the second ship they had unloaded this week, and the gang got 16 pence, a penny per man, for every score or 20 sacks of coal. A strong man with a big shovel could move a sackful in 2 minutes. He reckoned each man had earned £6 gross. However, there were deductions. Sidney Lennox, the middleman, or undertaker, sent vast quantities of beer and gin on board for the men. They had to drink a lot to replace the gallons of fluid they lost by sweating, but Lennox gave them more than was necessary, and most of the men drank it, gin too. Consequently, there was generally at least one accident before the end of the day, and the liquor had to be paid for. So Mac was not sure how much he would receive when he lined up for his wages at the Sun Tavern tonight. However, even if half the money was lost in deductions, an estimate surely too high, the remainder would still be double what a coal miner would earn for a 6-day week. And at that rate he could send for Esther in a few weeks. Then he and his twin would be free of slavery. His heart leaped at the prospect. He had written to Esther as soon as he settled at Dermot's place, and she had replied. His escape was the talk of the glen, she said. Some of the young hewers were trying to get up a petition to the English Parliament protesting against slavery in the mines. And Annie had married Jimmy Lee. Mac felt a pang of regret about Annie. He would never again roll in the heather with her. But Jimmy Lee was a good man. Perhaps the petition would be the beginning of a change. Perhaps the children of Jimmy and Annie would be free. The last of the coal was shoveled into sacks and stacked in a barge to be rowed to shore and stored in a coal yard. Mac stretched his aching back and shouldered his shovel. Up on deck, the cold air hit him like a blast, and he put on his shirt and the fur cloak Lizzie Hallam had given him. The coal heavers rowed to shore with the last of the sacks, then walked to the Sun to get their wages. The Sun was a rough place used by seamen and stevedores. Its earth floor was muddy, the benches and tables were battered and stained, and the smoky fire gave little heat. The landlord, Sidney Lennox, was a gambler, and there was always a game of some kind going on—cards, dice, or a complicated contest with a marked board and counters. The only good thing about the place was Black Mary, the African cook, who used shellfish and cheap cuts of meat to make spicy, hearty stews the customers loved. Mac and Dermot were the first to arrive. They found Peg sitting in the bar with her legs crossed underneath her, smoking Virginia tobacco in a clay pipe. She lived at the Sun, sleeping on the floor in a corner of the bar. Lennox was a receiver as well as an undertaker, and Peg sold him the things she stole. When she saw Mac, she spat into the fire and said cheerfully,
"What, old Chuck? Rescued any more maidens?"
"Not today," he grinned. Black Mary put her smiling face around the kitchen door.
"Oxtail soup, boys."
She had a low country's accent. People said she had once been the slave of a Dutch sea captain.
"No more than a couple of barrelfuls for me, please," Mac replied.
She smiled.
"Hungry, eh? Been working hard."
"Just taking a little exercise to give us an appetite," said Dermot.
Mac had no money to pay for his supper, but Lennox gave all the coal heavers credit against their earnings. After tonight, Mac resolved, he would pay cash on the nail for everything. He did not want to get into debt. He sat beside Peg.
"How's business?" he said facetiously.
She took his question seriously.
"Me and Cora tumbled a rich old gent this afternoon, so we're having the evening off."
Mac found it odd to be friends with a thief. He knew what drove her to it. She had no alternative but starvation. All the same, something in him, some residue of his mother's attitudes, made him disapprove. Peg was small and frail, with a bony frame and pretty blue eyes, but she had the callous air of a hardened criminal, and that was how people treated her. Mac suspected that her tough exterior was protective colouring. Below the surface, there was probably just a frightened little girl who had no one in the world to take care of her. Black Mary brought him soup with oysters floating in it, a slab of bread and a tankard of dark beer, and he fell on it like a wolf. The other coal heavers drifted in. There was no sign of Lennox, which was unusual. He was normally playing cards or dice with his customers. Mac wished he would hurry up. Mac was impatient to find out how much money he had made this week. He guessed Lennox was keeping the men waiting for their wages so that they would spend more at the bar. Cora came in after an hour or so. She looked as striking as ever in a mustard-coloured outfit with black trimmings. All the men greeted her, but to Mac's surprise she came and sat with him.
"I hear you had a profitable afternoon," he said.
"Easy money," she said. "A man old enough to know better."
"You'd better tell me how you do it, so I don't fall victim to someone like you."
She gave him a flirtatious look.
"You'll never have to pay girls, Mac. I can promise you that."
"Tell me anyway. I'm curious." "The simplest way is to pick up a wealthy drunk, get him amorous, take him down a dark alley, then run off with his money."
"Is that what you did today?"
"No, this was better. We found an empty house and bribed the caretaker. I played the role of a bored housewife. Peg was my maid. We took him to the house, pretending I lived there. I got his clothes off and got him into bed. Then Peg came rushing in to say my husband was back unexpectedly."
Peg laughed.
"Poor old geezer, you should have seen his face. He was terrified. He hid in the wardrobe. And we left with his wallet, his watch, and all his clothes." "He's probably still in that wardrobe," said Peg, and they both went off into gales of laughter.
The coal heavers' wives began to appear, many of them with babies in their arms and children clinging to their skirts. Some had the spirit and beauty of youth, but others looked weary and underfed, the beaten wives of violent and drunken men. Mac guessed they were all here in the hope of getting hold of some of the wages before all the money was drunk, gambled, or stolen by whores. Bridget Riley came in with her five children and sat with Dermot and Mac. Lennox finally showed up at midnight. He carried a leather sack full of coins and a pair of pistols, presumably to protect him from robbery. The coal heavers, most of whom were drunk by this time, cheered him like a conquering hero when he came in, and Mac felt a momentary contempt towards his workmates. Why did they show gratitude for what was no more than their due? Lennox was a surly man of about 30, wearing knee boots and a flannel waistcoat with no shirt. He was fit and muscular from carrying heavy kegs of beer and spirits. There was a cruel twist to his mouth. He had a distinctive odour, a sweet smell like rotting fruit. Mac noticed Peg flinch involuntarily as he went by. She was scared of the man. Lennox pulled a table into a corner and put the sack down and the pistols next to it. The men and women crowded around, pushing and shoving, as if afraid Lennox would run out of cash before their turn came. Mac hung back. It was beneath his dignity to scramble for the wages he had earned. He heard the harsh voice of Lennox raised over the hubbub.
"Each man has earned £1.11 this week before bar bills."
Mac was not sure he had heard right. They had unloaded two ships, some 1,500 score or 30,000 sacks of coal, giving each man a gross income of about £6. How could it have been reduced to little more than a pound each? There was a groan of disappointment from the men, but none of them questioned the figure. As Lennox began to count out individual payments, Mac said,
"Just a minute. How do you work that out?"
Lennox looked up with an angry scowl.
"You've unloaded 1,445 score, which gives each man £6.05 gross. Deduct 15 shillings a day for drink."
"What?"
Mac interrupted.
15 shillings a day?"
That was three quarters of their earnings. Dermot Riley muttered his agreement.
"Damned robbery it is."
He did not say it very loudly, but there were murmurs of agreement from some of the other men and women.
"My commission is 16 pence per man per ship," Lennox went on. "There's another 16 pence for the captain's tip, 6 pence per day for rent of a shovel."
"Rent of a shovel?"
Mac exploded.
"You're new here, and you don't know the rules, McCash," Lennox grated. "Why don't you shut your damned mouth and let me get on with it, or no one will get paid?"
Mac was outraged, but reason told him Lennox had not invented this system tonight. It was obviously well established, and the men must have accepted it. Peg tugged at his sleeve and said in a low voice,
"Don't cause trouble, Chuck. Lennox will make it worse for you somehow."
Mac shrugged and kept quiet. However, his protest had struck a chord among the others, and Dermot Riley now raised his voice.
"I didn't drink 15 shillings worth of liquor a day," he said.
His wife added, "For sure he didn't."
"Nor did I," said another man. "Who could? A man would burst with all that beer."
Lennox replied angrily,
"That's how much I sent on board for you. Do you think I can keep a tally of what every man drinks every day?" Mac said.
"If not, you're the only innkeeper in London who can't."
The men laughed. Lennox was infuriated by Mac's mockery and the laughter of the men. With a thunderous look, he said,
"The system is you pay for 15 shillings worth of liquor, whether you drink it or not."
Mac stepped up to the table.
"Well, I have a system too," he said. "I don't pay for liquor that I haven't asked for and haven't drunk. You may not have kept count, but I have, and I can tell you exactly what I owe you."
"So can I," said another man.
He was Charlie Smith, an English-born Negro with a flat Newcastle accent.
"I've drunk 83 tankards of the small beer you sell in here for 4 pence a pint. That's 27 shillings and 8 pence for the entire week, not 15 shillings a day."
Lennox said, "You're lucky to be paid at all, you black villain. You ought to be a slave in chains."
Charlie's expression darkened.
"I'm an Englishman and a Christian, and I'm a better man than you because I'm honest," he said with controlled fury.
Dermot Riley said,
"I can tell you exactly how much I've drunk too."
Lennox was getting irate.
"If you don't watch yourselves, you'll get nothing at all, any of you," he said.
It crossed Mac's mind that he ought to cool things down. He tried to think of something conciliatory to say. Then he caught sight of Bridget Riley and her hungry children, and indignation got the better of him. He said to Lennox,
"You'll not leave that table until you've paid what you owe."
Lennox's eyes fell to his pistols. With a swift movement, Mac swept the guns to the floor.
"You'll not escape by shooting me either, you damn thief," he said angrily.
Lennox looked like a cornered mastiff. Mac wondered if he had gone too far. Perhaps he should have left room for a face-saving compromise, but it was too late now. Lennox had to back down. He had made the coal heavers drunk, and they would kill him unless he paid them. He sat back in his chair, narrowed his eyes, gave Mac a look of pure hatred, and said,
"You'll suffer for this, McCash. I swear by God you will."
Mac said mildly,
"Come on, Lennox. The men are only asking you to pay them what they're due."
Lennox was not mollified, but he gave in. Scowling darkly, he began to count out money. He paid Charlie Smith first, then Dermot Riley, then Mac, taking their word for the amount of liquor they had consumed. Mac stepped away from the table full of elation. He had £3.09 in his hand. If he put half of it aside for Esther, he would still be flush. Other coal heavers made guesses at how much they had drunk, but Lennox did not argue, except in the case of Sam Potter, a huge fat boy from Cork, who claimed he had drunk only 30 quarts, causing uproarious laughter from the others. He eventually settled for 3 times that. An air of jubilation spread among the men and their women as they pocketed their earnings. Several came up to Mac and slapped him on the back, and Bridget Riley kissed him. He realized he had done something remarkable, but he feared that the drama was not yet ended. Lennox had given in too easily. As the last man was being paid, Mac picked up Lennox's guns from the floor. He blew the flintlocks clear of powder so that they would not fire, then placed them on the table. Lennox took his disarmed pistols and the nearly empty money bag and stood up. The room went quiet. He went to the door which led to his private rooms. Everyone watched him intently, as if they were afraid he might yet find a way to take the money back. He turned at the door.
"Go home, all of you," he said malevolently, "and don't come back on Monday. There'll be no work for you. You're all dismissed."
Mac lay awake most of the night, worrying. Some of the coal heavers said Lennox would have forgotten all about it by Monday morning, but Mac doubted that. Lennox did not seem the type of man to swallow defeat, and he could easily get another 16 strong young men to form his gang. It was Mac's fault. The coal heavers were like oxen, strong and stupid and easily led. They would not have rebelled against Lennox if Mac had not encouraged them. Now he felt it was up to him to set matters right. He got up early on Sunday morning and went into the other room. Dermot and his wife lay on a mattress, and the 5 children slept together in the opposite corner. Mac shook Dermot awake.
"We've got to find work for our gang before tomorrow," Mac said.
Dermot got up. Bridget mumbled from the bed,
"Wear something respectable now if you want to impress an undertaker."
Dermot put on an old red waistcoat, and he loaned Mac the blue silk neckcloth he had bought for his wedding. They called for Charlie Smith on the way. Charlie had been a coal heaver for 5 years, and he knew everyone. He put on his best blue coat, and they went together to Wapping. The muddy streets of the waterfront neighbourhood were almost deserted. The bells of London's hundreds of churches called the devout to their prayers, but most of the sailors and stevedores and warehousemen were enjoying their day of rest, and they stayed at home. The brown River Thames lapped lazily at the deserted wharves, and rats sauntered boldly along the foreshore. All the coal-heaving undertakers were tavern keepers. The 3 men went first to the frying pan, a few yards from the sun. They found the landlord boiling a ham in the yard. The smell made Mac's mouth water.
"What ho, Harry?"
Charlie addressed him cheerfully. He gave them a sour look.
"What do you boys want if it's not beer?"
"Work," Charlie replied. "Have you got a shipped one called tomorrow?"
"Yes, ain't a gang to do it, thanks all the same."
They left. Dermot said,
"What was the matter with him? He looked at us like lepers."
"Too much gin last night," Charlie speculated.
Mac feared it might have been something more sinister, but he kept his thoughts to himself for the moment.
"Let's go into the King's Head," he said.
Several coal heavers were drinking beer at the bar and greeted Charlie by name.
"Are you busy, my lads?" Charlie said. "We're looking for a ship."
The landlord overheard. "You men been working for Sidney Lennox at the Sun?"
"Yes, but he doesn't need us next week," Charlie replied.
"Nor do I," said the landlord.
As they went out, Charlie said,
"We'll try Buck Delaney at the Swan. He runs 2 or 3 gangs at a time."
The Swan was a busy tavern with stables, a coffee room, and a coal yard and several bars. They found the Irish landlord in his private room overlooking the courtyard. Delaney had been a coal heaver himself in his youth, though now he wore a wig and a lace cravat to take his breakfast of coffee and cold beef.
"Let me give you a tip, me boys," he said. "Every undertaker in London has heard what happened at the Sun last night. There's not one will employ you. Sidney Lennox has made sure of that."
Mac's heart sank. He had been afraid of something like this.
"If I were you," Delaney went on, "I'd take ship and get out of town for 1 or 2. When you come back, it will all be forgotten."
Dermot said angrily,
"Are the coal heavers always to be robbed by you undertakers, then?"
If Delaney was offended, he did not show it.
"Look around you, me boy," he said mildly,
indicating with a vague wave the silver coffee service, the carpeted room, and the bustling business that paid for it all.
"I didn't get this by being fair to people."
Mac said,
"What's to stop us going to the captains ourselves and undertaking to unload ships?"
"Everything," said Delaney. "Now and again there comes along a coal heaver like you, Macash, with a bit more gumption than the rest, and he wants to run his own gang. and cut out the undertaker, and do away with liquor payments and all and all. But there's too many people making too much money out of the present arrangement. He shook his head. You're not the first to protest against the system, Macash, and you won't be the last. Mac was disgusted by Delaney's cynicism, but he felt the man was telling the truth. He could not think of anything else to say or do. Feeling defeated, he went to the door, and Dermot and Charlie followed.
Take my advice, Macash, Delaney said. Be like me. Get yourself a little tavern and sell liquor to coal heavers. Stop trying to help them and start helping yourself. You could do well. You've got it in you, I can tell.
Be like you, Mac said. You've made yourself rich by cheating your fellow men. By Christ, I wouldn't be like you for a kingdom.
As he went out, he was gratified to see Delaney's face darken in anger at last. But his satisfaction lasted no longer than it took to close the door. He had won an argument and lost everything else. If only he had swallowed his pride and accepted the undertaker's system, he would at least have work to do tomorrow morning. Now he had nothing, and he had put 15 other men and their families in the same hopeless position. The prospect of bringing Esther to London was farther away than ever. He had handled everything wrongly. He was a damn fool. The three men sat in one of the bars and ordered beer and bread for their breakfast. Mac reflected that he had been arrogant to look down on the coal heavers for accepting their lot dumbly. In his mind he had called them oxen, but he was the ox. He thought of Caspar Gordonson, the radical lawyer who had started all this by telling Mac his legal rights. If I could get hold of Gordonson, Mac thought, I'd let him know what legal rights are worth. The law was only useful to those who had the power to enforce it, it seemed. Coal miners and coal heavers had no advocate at court. They were fools to talk of their rights. The smart people ignored right and wrong and took care of themselves, like Cora and Peg and Buck Delaney. He picked up his tankard, then froze with it halfway to his mouth. Caspar Gordonson lived in London, of course. Mac could get hold of him. He could let him know what legal rights were worth. But perhaps he could do better than that. Perhaps Gordonson would be the coal heaver's advocate. He was a lawyer, and he wrote constantly about English liberty. He ought to help. It was worth a try. The fatal letter Mac received from Caspar Gordonson had come from an address in Fleet Street. The Fleet was a filthy stream running into the Thames at the foot of the hill upon which St. Paul's Cathedral stood. Gordonson lived in a three-story brick row house next to a large tavern.
He must be a bachelor, said Dermot.
How do you know? Charlie Smith asked. Dirty windows, doorstep not polished, there's no lady in this house.
A manservant let them in, showing no surprise when they asked for Mr. Gordonson. As they entered, two well-dressed men were leaving, continuing as they went a heated discussion that involved William Pitt, the Lord Privy Seal, and Viscount Weymouth, a Secretary of State. They did not pause in their argument, but one nodded to Mac with absent-minded politeness, which surprised him greatly, since gentlemen normally ignored low-class people. Mac had imagined a lawyer's house to be a place of dusty documents and whispered secrets, in which the loudest noise was the slow scratching of pens. Gordonson's home was more like a printer's shop. Pamphlets and journals in string-tied bundles were stacked in the hall, the air smelled of cut paper and printing ink, and the sound of machinery from below stairs suggested that a press was being operated in the basement. The servant stepped into a room off the hall. Mac wondered if he was wasting his time. People who wrote clever articles in journals probably did not dirty their hands by getting involved with working men. Gordonson's interest in liberty might be strictly theoretical. But Mac had to try everything. He had led his coal-heaving gang into rebellion, and now they were all without work. He had to do something. A loud and shrill voice came from within.
Macash? Never heard of him. Who is he? You don't know? Then ask! Never mind.
A moment later, a balding man with no wig appeared in the doorway and peered at the three coal heavers through spectacles.
I don't think I know any of you, he said. What do you want with me?
It was a discouraging introduction, but Mac was not easily disheartened, and he said spiritedly,
You gave me some very bad advice recently, but despite that, I've come back for more.
There was a pause, and Mac thought he had given offence. Then Gordonson laughed heartily. In a friendly voice, he said,
Who are you, anyway?
Malachy Macash, known as Mac. I was a coal miner at Hugh, near Edinburgh, until you wrote and told me I was a free man.
Understanding lit up Gordonson's expression.
You're the liberty-loving miner. Shake hands, man.
Mac introduced Dermot and Charlie.
Come in, all of you. Have a glass of wine.
They followed him into an untidy room furnished with a writing table and walls of bookcases. More publications were piled on the floor, and printers' proofs were scattered across the table. A fat old dog lay on a stained rug in front of the fire. There was a ripe smell that must have come from the rug, or the dog, or both. Mac lifted an open law book from a chair and sat down.
"I won't take any wine, thank you," he said. He wanted his wits about him.
"A cup of coffee, perhaps? Wine sends you to sleep, but coffee wakes you up."
Without waiting for a reply, he said to the servant,
"Coffee for everyone."
He turned back to Mac.
"Now, Macash, why was my advice to you so wrong?"
Mac told him the story of how he had left Hugh. Dermot and Charlie listened intently. They had never heard this. Gordonson lit a pipe and blew clouds of tobacco smoke, shaking his head in disgust from time to time. The coffee came as Mac was finishing.
"I know the Jamiesons of old. They're greedy, heartless, brutal people," Gordonson said with feeling. "What did you do when you got to London?"
"I became a coal heaver,"
Mac related what had happened in the Sun Tavern last night. Gordonson said,
"The liquor payments to coal heavers are a long-standing scandal."
Mac nodded.
"I've been told I'm not the first to protest."
"Indeed not. Parliament actually passed a law against the practice 10 years ago."
Mac was astonished.
"Then how does it continue?"
"The law has never been enforced."
"Why not?"
"The government is afraid of disrupting the supply of coal. London runs on coal. Nothing happens here without it. No bread is made, no beer brewed, no glass blown, no iron smelted, no horses shod, no nails manufactured."
"I understand," Mac interrupted impatiently. "I ought not to be surprised that the law does nothing for men such as us."
"Now, you're wrong about that,"
Gordonson said in a pedantic tone.
"The law makes no decisions. It has no will of its own. It's like a weapon or a tool. It works for those who pick it up and use it."
"The rich."
"Usually,"
Gordonson conceded.
"But it might work for you."
"How?" Mac said eagerly.
"Suppose you devised an alternative ganging system for unloading coal ships."
This was what Mac had been hoping for.
"It wouldn't be difficult," he said. "The men could choose one of their number to be undertaker and deal with the captains. The money would be shared out as soon as it's received."
"I presume the coal heavers would prefer to work under the new system and be free to spend their wages as they pleased."
"Yes," Mac said, suppressing his mounting excitement. "They could pay for their beer as they drink it, the way anyone does."
But would Gordonson weigh in on the side of the coal heavers? If that happened, everything could change. Charlie Smith said lugubriously,
"It's been tried before. It doesn't work."
Charlie had been a coal heaver for many years, Mac recalled. He asked,
"Why doesn't it work?" "What happens is, the undertakers bribe the ship's captains not to use the new gangs. Then there's trouble and fighting between the gangs. And it's the new gangs that get punished for the fights because the magistrates are undertakers themselves, or friends of undertakers. And in the end, all the coal heavers go back to the old ways."
"Damn fools," Mac said. Charlie looked offended.
"I suppose if they were clever, there wouldn't be coal heavers."
Mac realized he had been supercilious, but it angered him when men were their own worst enemies.
"They only need a little determination and solidarity," he said.
Gordonson put in,
"There's more to it than that. It's a question of politics. I remember the last coal heavers' dispute. They were defeated because they had no champion. The undertakers were against them, and no one was for them."
"Why should it be different this time?" said Mac.
"Because of John Wilkes."
"Wilkes was the defender of liberty, but he was in exile."
"He can't do much for us in Paris."
"He's not in Paris. He's back."
That was a surprise.
"What's he going to do?"
"Stand for Parliament."
Mac could imagine how that would stir up trouble in London's political circles.
"But I still don't see how it helps us."
"Wilkes will take the coal heavers' part, and the government will side with the undertakers. Such a dispute, with working men plainly in the right and having the law on their side too, would do Wilkes nothing but good."
"How do you know what Wilkes will do?"
Gordonson smiled.
"I'm his electoral agent."
Gordonson was more powerful than Mac had realized. This was a piece of luck. Charlie Smith, still sceptical, said,
"So you're planning to use the coal heavers to advance your own political purposes?"
"Fair point,"
Gordonson said mildly. He put down his pipe.
"But why do I support Wilkes? Let me explain. You came to me today complaining of injustice. This kind of thing happens all too often. Ordinary men and women, cruelly abused for the benefit of some greedy brute, a George Jamison or a Sidney Lennox. It harms trade because the bad enterprises undermine the good. And even if it were good for trade, it would be wicked. I love my country, and I hate the brutes who would destroy its people and ruin its prosperity. So I spend my life fighting for justice.
He smiled and put his pipe back in his mouth.
I hope that doesn't sound too pompous.
Not at all, said Mac. I'm glad you're on our side.
Chapter 16. Jay Jamison's wedding day was cold and damp. From his bedroom in Grosvenor Square, he could see Hyde Park, where his regiment was bivouacked. A low mist covered the ground, and the soldiers' tents looked like ship's sails on a swirling grey sea. Dull fires smoked here and there, adding to the fog. The men would be miserable, but soldiers were always miserable. He turned from the window. Chip Marlborough, his bride man, was holding Jay's new coat. Jay shrugged into it with a grunt of thanks. Chip was a captain in the 3rd Foot Guards, like Jay. His father was Lord Arbury, who had business dealings with Jay's father. Jay was flattered that such an aristocratic scion had agreed to stand beside him on his wedding day. "Have you seen to the horses?" Jay asked anxiously.
"Of course," said Chip.
Although the 3rd Foot was an infantry regiment, officers always went mounted, and Jay's responsibility was to supervise the men who looked after the horses. He was good with horses. He understood them instinctively. He had 2 days' leave for his wedding, but he still worried whether the beasts were being looked after properly. His leave was so short because the regiment was on active service. There was no war. The last war the British Army had fought was the 7 Years' War against the French in America, and that had ended while Jay and Chip were schoolboys. But the people of London were so restless and turbulent that the troops were standing by to suppress riots. Every few days some group of angry craftsmen went on strike, or marched on Parliament, or ran through the streets breaking windows. Only this week silk weavers, outraged by a reduction in their rate of pay, had destroyed 3 of the new engine looms in Spitalfields.
"I hope the regiment isn't called out while I'm on leave," Jay said. "It would be just my luck to miss the action."
"Stop worrying."
Chip poured brandy from a decanter into 2 glasses. He was a great brandy drinker.
"To love,"
he said.
"To love,"
Jay repeated. End of side 8. Side 9. He did not know much about love, he reflected. He had lost his virginity 5 years ago with Arabella, one of his father's housemaids. He thought at the time that he was seducing her, but looking back, he could see that it had been the other way round. After he had shared her bed 3 times, she said she was pregnant. He had paid her £30, which he borrowed from a moneylender, to disappear. He now suspected she had never been pregnant, and the whole thing was a deliberate swindle. Since then, he had flirted with dozens of girls, kissed many of them, and bedded a few. He found it easy to charm a girl. It was mainly a matter of pretending to be interested in everything she said, although good looks and good manners helped. He bowled them over without much effort. But now, for the first time, he had suffered the same treatment. When he was with Lizzie, he always felt slightly breathless, and he knew that he stared at her, as if she were the only person in the room, the way a girl stared at him when he was being fascinating. Was that love? He thought it must be. His father had mellowed towards the marriage because of the possibility of getting at Lizzie's coal. That was why he was having Lizzie and her mother to stay in the guest house and paying the rent on the Chapel Street house where Jay and Lizzie would live after the wedding. They had not made any firm promises to father, but nor had they told him that Lizzie was dead set against mining in Hyde Glen. Jay just hoped it would work out all right in the end. The door opened and a footman said,
"Will you see a Mr. Lennox, sir?"
Jay's heart sank. He owed Sidney Lennox money, gambling losses. He would have sent the man away. He was only a tavern keeper. But then Lennox might turn nasty about the debt.
"You'd better show him in," Jay said. "I'm sorry about this," he said to Chip.
"I know Lennox," Chip said. "I've lost money to him myself."
Lennox walked in, and Jay noticed the distinctive sweet-sour smell of the man, like something fermenting. Chip greeted him.
"How are you, you damned rogue?"
Lennox gave him a cool look.
You don't call me a damn rogue when you win, I notice.
Jay regarded him nervously. Lennox wore a yellow suit and silk stockings with buckled shoes, but he looked like a jackal dressed as a man. There was an air of menace about him that fancy clothes could not conceal. However, Jay could not quite bring himself to break with Lennox. He was a very useful acquaintance. He always knew where there was a cockfight, a gladiatorial combat, or a horse race, and if all else failed, he would start a card school or a dice game himself. He was also willing to give credit to young officers who ran out of cash but wanted to continue gambling, and that was the trouble. Jay owed Lennox £150. It would be embarrassing if Lennox insisted on collecting the debt now.
"You know I'm getting married today, Lennox," Jay said. "Yes, I know that," Lennox said. "I came to drink your health."
By all means, Chip, a tot for our friend."
Chip poured three generous measures of brandy. Lennox said, "To you and your bride."
"Thank you," said Jay, and the three men drank.
Lennox addressed Chip.
"There'll be a big faro game tomorrow night at Lord Archer's Coffee House, Captain Marlborough."
"It sounds good to me," said Chip.
"I'll hope to see you there. No doubt you'll be too busy, Captain Jamieson."
"I expect so," Jay replied.
"Anyway, I can't afford it," he thought to himself. Lennox put down his glass.
"I wish you a good day and hope the fog lifts," he said and went out.
Jay concealed his relief. Nothing had been said about the money. Lennox knew that Jay's father had paid the last debt, and perhaps he felt confident that Sir George would do the same again. Jay wondered why Lennox had come. Surely not just to catch a free glass of brandy. He had an unpleasant feeling that Lennox had been making some kind of point. There was an unspoken threat in the air. But what could a tavern keeper do to the son of a wealthy merchant in the end? From the street, Jay heard the sound of carriages drawing up in front of the house. He put Lennox out of his mind. "Let's go downstairs," he said. The drawing room was a grand space with expensive furniture made by Thomas Chippendale. It smelled of wax polish. Jay's mother, father, and brother were there, all dressed for church. Alicia kissed Jay. Sir George and Robert greeted him awkwardly. They had never been an affectionate family, and the row over the 21st birthday gift was still fresh in their memories. A footman was pouring coffee. Jay and Chip each took a cup. Before they could sip it, the door flew open, and Lizzie came in like a hurricane.
"How dare you!" she stormed. "How dare you!"
Jay's heart missed a beat. What was the matter now? Lizzie was pink with indignation, her eyes flashing, her bosom heaving. She was wearing her bridal outfit, a simple white dress with a white cap, but she looked ravishing.
"What have I done?"
Jay asked plaintively.
"The wedding is off," she replied.
"No," Jay cried. Surely she was not to be snatched from him at the last moment. The thought was unbearable. Lady Hallam hurried in after her, looking distraught.
"Lizzie, please stop this," she said.
Jay's mother took charge.
"Lizzie, dear, what on earth is the trouble? Please tell us what has made you so distressed." "This," she said, and she fluttered a sheaf of papers.
Lady Hallam was wringing her hands.
"It's a letter from my head keeper," she said.
Lizzie said,
"It says that surveyors employed by the Jamiesons have been sinking boreholes on the Hallam estate."
"Boreholes?" Jay said, mystified. He looked at Robert and saw a furtive expression on his face. Lizzie said impatiently,
"They're looking for coal, of course."
"Oh, no," Jay protested. He understood what had happened. His impatient father had jumped the gun. He was so eager to get at Lizzie's coal that he had not been able to wait until the wedding. But father's impatience might have lost Jay his bride. The thought made Jay angry enough to shout at his father,
"You damn fool," he said recklessly. "Look what you've done."
It was a shocking thing for a son to say, and Sir George was not used to opposition from anyone. He went red in the face and his eyes bulged.
"Call off the damned wedding, then," he roared. "What do I care?"
Alicia intervened.
"Calm down, Jay, and you too, Lizzie," she said, and she meant Sir George as well, though she tactfully did not say so. "There has obviously been a mistake. No doubt Sir George's surveyors misunderstood some instructions. Lady Hallam, please take Lizzie back to the guest house and allow us to sort this out. I feel sure we do not need to do anything so drastic as to call off the wedding."
Chip Marlborough coughed. Jay had forgotten he was there.
"If you'll excuse me," Chip said. He went to the door. "Don't leave the house," Jay pleaded. "Wait upstairs."
"Certainly," Chip said, although his face showed that he would rather be anywhere else in the world. Alicia gently ushered Lizzie and Lady Hallam towards the door behind Chip.
"Please, just give me a few minutes, and I will come and see you, and everything will be all right."
As Lizzie went out, she was looking more doubtful than angry, and Jay hoped she realized he had not known about the boreholes. His mother closed the door and turned around. Jay prayed she could do something to save the wedding.
Did she have a plan? She was so clever. It was his only hope.
She did not remonstrate with his father. Instead, she said, "If there's no wedding, you won't get your coal."
"High Glen is bankrupt," Sir George replied,
"but Lady Hallam could renew her mortgages with another lender. She doesn't know that. Someone will tell her." There was a pause while that threat sank in. Jay was afraid his father would explode, but Mother was a good judge of how far he could be pushed, and in the end he said resignedly,
"What do you want, Alicia?"
Jay breathed a sigh of relief. Perhaps his wedding might be saved after all. Mother said, "First of all, Jay must speak to Lizzie and convince her that he did not know about the surveyors."
"It's true," Jay interjected. "Shut up and listen," his father said brutally.
Mother went on, "If he can do that, they can get married as planned."
"Then what?"
"Then be patient. In time, Jay and I can talk Lizzie around. She's against coal mining now, but she will change her mind, or at least become less passionate about it, especially when she has a home and a baby and begins to understand the importance of money." Sir George shook his head.
"It's not good enough, Alicia. I can't wait."
"Why ever not?" He paused and looked at Robert, who shrugged.
"I suppose I might as well tell you," Father said. "I've got debts of my own. You know we have always run on borrowed money, most of it from Lord Arbury. In the past, we've made profits for ourselves and for him. But our trade with America has fallen very low since the trouble started in the colonies, and it's almost impossible to get paid for what little business we do. Our biggest debtor has gone bust, leaving me with a tobacco plantation in Virginia that I can't sell."
Jay was stunned. It had never occurred to him that the family enterprises were risky and that the wealth he had always known might not last forever. He began to see why his father had been so enraged at having to pay his gambling debts. Father went on,
"The coal has been keeping us going, but it's not enough. Lord Arbury wants his money. So I have to have the Hallam estate. Otherwise I could lose my entire business."
There was a silence. Both Jay and his mother were too shocked to speak. Eventually Alicia said, "Then there is only one solution. High Glen will have to be mined without Lizzie's knowledge." Jay frowned anxiously. That proposal frightened him, but he decided not to say anything just yet.
"How could it be done?" said Sir George.
"Send her and Jay to another country." Jay was startled.
"What a clever idea." "But Lady Hallam would know," he said, "and she'll be sure to tell Lizzie."
Alicia shook her head. "No, she won't. She'll do anything to make this marriage happen. She'll keep quiet if we tell her to."
Jay said,
"But where would we go? What country?"
"Barbados," said his mother.
"No," Robert interjected. "Jay can't have the sugar plantation."
Alicia said quietly,
"I think your father will give it up if the survival of the entire family enterprise depends upon it."
Robert's face wore a triumphant look.
"Father can't, even if he wants to. The plantation already belongs to me."
Alicia looked inquiringly at Sir George.
"Is that true? Is it his?"
Sir George nodded.
"I made it over to him."
"When?"
"3 years ago.
That was another shock. Jay had no idea. He felt wounded.
"That's why you wouldn't give it to me for my birthday," he said sadly. "You had already given it to Robert."
Alicia said,
"But Robert, surely you'd give it back to save the entire business?"
"No," Robert said hotly. "This is only the beginning. You'll start by stealing the plantation, and in the end you'll get everything. I know you've always wanted to take the business from me and give it to that little bastard."
"All I want for Jay is a fair share," she replied.
Sir George said,
Robert, if you don't do this, it could mean bankruptcy for all of us.
Not for me, he said triumphantly. I'll still have a plantation.
But you could have so much more, said Sir George.
Robert looked sly. All right, I'll do it. On one condition, that you sign over the rest of the business to me. I mean everything, and you retire.
No, Sir George shouted. I won't retire. I am not yet 50 years old.
They glared at one another, Robert and Sir George, and Jay thought how similar they were. Neither would give in over this, he knew, and his heart sank. It was an impasse. The two stubborn men were deadlocked, and between them they would ruin everything, the wedding, the business, and the family's future. But Alicia was not ready to give up. What's this Virginia property, George?
Mockjack Hall. It's a tobacco plantation, about 1,000 acres and 50 slaves. What are you thinking?
You could give that to Jay. Jay's heart leaped. Virginia. It would be the fresh start he had longed for, away from his father and brother, with a place of his own to manage and cultivate. And Lizzie would jump at the chance.
Sir George's eyes narrowed. I couldn't give him any money, he said. He'd have to borrow what he needed to get the place going.
Jay said quickly, I don't care about that.
Alicia put in, but you'd have to pay the interest on Lady Hallam's mortgages, otherwise she could lose High Glen. I can do that out of the income from the coal, Father went on thinking out the details. They'll have to leave for Virginia immediately, within a few weeks.
They can't do that, Alicia protested. They have to make preparations, give them 3 months at least.
He shook his head. I need the coal sooner than that.
That's all right. Lizzie won't want to make the journey back to Scotland. She'll be too busy preparing for her new life.
All this talk of deceiving Lizzie filled Jay with trepidation. He was the one who would suffer her wrath if she found out.
What if someone writes to her? He said.
Alicia looked thoughtful. We need to know which of the servants at High Glen House might do that.
You can find that out, Jay. How will we stop them?
We'll send someone up there to dismiss them. Sir George said, That could work. All right, we'll do it.
Alicia turned to Jay and smiled triumphantly. She had got him his patrimony after all. She put her arms around him and kissed him. Bless you, my dear son, she said. Now go to her and tell her that you and your family are desperately sorry about this mistake, and that your father has given you Mockjack Hall as a wedding present. Jay hugged her and whispered, Well done, mother. Thank you. He went out. As he walked across the garden, he felt jubilant and apprehensive at the same time. He had got what he had always wanted. He wished it could have been done without deceiving his bride. But there was no other way. If he had refused, he would have lost the property, and he might have lost her as well. He went into the little guest house adjoining the stables. Lady Hallam and Lizzie were in the modest drawing room, sitting by a smoky coal fire. They had both been crying. Jay felt a sudden dangerous impulse to tell Lizzie the truth. If he revealed the deception planned by the parents and asked her to marry him and live in poverty, she might say yes. But the risk scared him, and their dream of going to a new country would die. Sometimes, he told himself, a lie was kinder. But would she believe it? He knelt in front of her. Her wedding dress smelled of lavender.
My father is very sorry, he said. He sent in the surveyors as a surprise for me. He thought we'd be pleased to know if there was coal on your land. He didn't know how strongly you felt about mining.
She looked skeptical.
Why didn't you tell him?
He spread his hands in a gesture of helplessness.
He never asked.
She still looked stubborn, but he had another card up his sleeve.
And there's something else. Our wedding present.
She frowned.
What is it? Mockjack Hall, a tobacco plantation in Virginia. We can go there as soon as we like.
She stared at him in surprise.
It's what we always wanted, isn't it? He said. A fresh start in a new country, an adventure.
Slowly her face broke into a smile.
Really? Virginia? Can it really be true?
He could hardly believe she would consent.
Will you accept it, then?
He said fearfully. She smiled. Tears came to her eyes, and she could not speak. She nodded dumbly. Jay realized he had won. He had got everything he wanted.
The feeling was like winning a big hand at cards. It was time to rake in his profits. He stood up. He drew her out of her chair and gave her his arm.
"Come with me, then," he said. "Let's get married."
Chapter 17. At noon on the third day, the hold of the Durham Primrose was empty of coal. Mac looked around, hardly able to believe it had really happened. They had done it all without an undertaker. They had watched the riverside and picked out a coal ship that arrived in the middle of the day when the other gangs were already working. While the men waited on the river bank, Mac and Charlie rowed out to the ship as it anchored and offered their services, starting immediately. The captain knew that if he held out for a regular gang, he would have to wait until the following day, and time was money to ship's captains, so he hired them. The men seemed to work faster, knowing they would be paid in full. They still drank beer all day, but paying for it jar by jar, they took only what they needed, and they uncoaled the ship in 48 hours. Mac shouldered his shovel and went on deck. The weather was cold and misty, but Mac was hot from the hold. As the last sack of coal was thrown down onto the boat, a great cheer went up from the coal heavers. Mac conferred with the first mate. The boat carried 500 sacks, and they had both kept count of the number of round trips it had made. Now they counted the odd sacks left for the last trip and agreed the total. Then they went to the captain's cabin. Mac hoped there would be no last-minute snags. They had done the work. They had to be paid now, didn't they? The captain was a thin, middle-aged man with a big red nose. He smelled of rum.
"Finished," he said. "You're quicker than the usual gangs. What's the tally?"
600 score, all but 93, the first mate said, and Mac nodded. They counted in scores or 20s because each man was paid a penny per score. He beckoned them inside and sat down with an abacus.
600 score less 93 at 16 pence per score.
It was a complicated sum, but Mac was used to being paid by the weight of coal he produced, and he could do mental arithmetic when his wages depended on it. The captain had a key on a chain attached to his belt. He used it to open a chest that stood in the corner. Mac stared as he took out a smaller box, put it on the table, and opened it.
"If we call the odd 7 sacks a half score, I owe you £39.14 exactly."
And he counted out the money. The captain gave him a linen bag to carry it in, and included plenty of pennies so that he could share it out exactly among the men. Mac felt a tremendous sense of triumph as he held the money in his hands. Each man had earned almost £2.10, more in 2 days than they got for 2 weeks with Lennox. But more importantly, they had proved they could stand up for their rights and win justice. He sat cross-legged on the deck of the ship to pay the men out. The first in line, Amos Type, said,
"Thank you, Mac, and God bless you, boy."
"Don't thank me. You earned it,"
Mac protested. Despite his protest, the next man thanked him in the same way, as if he were a prince dispensing favors.
"It's not just the money," Mac said, as the third man, slash Harley, stepped forward. "We've won our dignity, too." "You can have that dignity, Mac," said Slash. "Just give me the money."
The others laughed. Mac felt a little angry with them as he continued to count out the coins. Why could they not see that this was more than a matter of today's wages? When they were so stupid about their own interests, he felt they deserved to be abused by undertakers. However, nothing could mar his victory. As they were all rowed to shore, the men began lustily to sing a very obscene song called "The Mayor of Bayswater," and Mac joined in at the top of his voice. He and Dermot walked to Spitalfields. The morning fog was lifting. Mac had a tune on his lips and a spring in his step. When he entered his room, a pleasant surprise was waiting for him. Sitting on a three-legged stool, smelling of sandalwood and swinging a shapely leg, was Peg's red-haired friend Cora, in a chestnut-coloured coat and a jaunty hat. She had picked up his cloak, which normally lay on the straw mattress that was his bed, and she was stroking the fur.
"Where did you get this?" she said.
"It was a gift from a fine lady," he said with a grin. "What are you doing here?"
"I came to see you," she said. "If you wash your face, you can walk out with me. That is, if you don't have to go to tea with any fine ladies."
He must have appeared doubtful, for she added,
"Don't look so startled. You probably think I'm a whore, but I'm not, except in desperation."
He took his sliver of soap
and went down to the standpipe in the yard. Cora followed him and watched as he stripped to the waist and washed the coal dust from his skin and hair. He borrowed a clean shirt from Dermot, put on his coat and hat, and took Cora's arm. They walked west through the heart of the city. In London, Mac had learned, people walked the streets for recreation the way they walked the hills in Scotland. He enjoyed having Cora on his arm. He liked the way her hips swayed so that she touched him every now and again. Because of her striking colouring and her dashing clothes, she attracted a lot of attention, and Mac got envious looks from other men. They went into a tavern and ordered oysters, bread, and the strong beer called porter. Cora ate with gusto, swallowing the oysters whole and washing them down with draughts of dark ale. When they went out again, the weather had changed. It was still cool, but there was a little weak sunshine. They strolled into the rich residential district called Mayfair. In his first 22 years, Mac had seen only 2 palatial homes, Jamieson Castle and Hyde Lane House. In this neighbourhood there were 2 such houses on every street, and another 50 only a little less magnificent. London's wealth never ceased to astonish him. Outside one of the very grandest, a series of carriages was drawing up and depositing guests as if for a party. On the pavement either side was a small crowd of passers-by and servants from neighbouring houses, and people were looking out from their doors and windows. The house was a blaze of light, although it was mid-afternoon, and the entrance was decorated with flowers.
"It must be a wedding," Cora said.
As they watched, another carriage drew up, and a familiar figure stepped out. Mac gave a start as he recognized Jay Jamieson. Jay handed his bride down from the carriage, and the bystanders cheered and clapped.
"She's pretty," Cora said.
Lizzie smiled and looked around, acknowledging the applause. Her eyes met Mac's, and for a moment she froze. He smiled and waved. She averted her eyes quickly and hurried inside. It had taken only a fraction of a second, but the sharp-eyed Cora had not missed it.
"Do you know her?"
"She's the one who gave me the fur," Mac said.
"I hope her husband doesn't know she gives presents to coal heavers."
"She's throwing herself away on Jay Jamieson. He's a handsome weakling."
"I suppose you think she'd be better off marrying you,"
Cora said sarcastically.
"She would too," Mac said seriously.
"Shall we go to the theatre?" Late that evening, Lizzie and Jay sat up in bed in the bridal chamber, wearing their nightclothes, surrounded by giggling relations and friends, all more or less drunk. The older generation had long since left the room, but custom insisted that wedding guests should hang on, tormenting the couple, who were assumed to be in a desperate hurry to consummate their marriage. The day had passed in a whirl. She had hardly thought about Jay's betrayal, his apology, her pardon, and their future in Virginia. There had been no time to ask herself whether she had made the right decision. Chip Marlborough came in carrying a jug of posset. Pinned to his hat was one of Lizzie's garters. He proceeded to fill everyone's glasses.
"A toast," he said. "A final toast," said Jay, but they all laughed and jeered.
Lizzie sipped her drink, a mixture of wine, milk and egg yolk, with sugar and cinnamon. She was exhausted. It had been a long day, from the morning's terrible quarrel and its surprisingly happy ending, through the church